Can giving insulin prevent type 1 diabetes?
The long-term sequela after Ebola infection.
What should you do about the first-time seizure in adults?
And autism and vaccination in kids at low or high risk for autism.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on April 24th, 2015, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'm going to just go ahead and groan here for a moment about, once again, this ostensible purported relationship between vaccines and autism. The Journal of the American Medical Association stepping into the fray with this study, hopefully helping to nail this down once and for all.
So, Elizabeth, first of all, explain why you're groaning.
Oh, come on. We know that the only study that ever showed a real relationship was retracted, and yet the myth persists.
All right. So what you're alluding to, the fact is that there really is no link between the mumps, measles, and rubella vaccine and autism. Despite the fact you and I know that, there's still a widely held belief that there's a relationship between the two. So these investigators took a little bit of a different approach at looking at this. They looked at the autism occurrence by vaccination with MMR among U.S. children with older siblings, either with or without autism. And we know that if a family has a child with autism, there's a higher likelihood that younger siblings may get it. Therefore, you've selected a higher risk group. They did a retrospective cohort study, and they used a database from a very large commercial health plan. And this health plan looked at over 95,000 children who had older siblings. Among those, about 1% were diagnosed with one of the autism spectrum disorders. And what they discovered, to no surprise, was that in children who had an older sibling with autism, those that received vaccination were no more likely to develop autism than those that did not. In fact, the rate was actually a little bit lower. And they extended that. Well, what about children who did not have a sibling with autism? And the same thing was true. Very good data that receipt of an MMR vaccination is not associated with an increased risk of autism, regardless of whether the older sibling does or does not have autism.
I hope all the parents out there are going to heed this message and get their kids vaccinated. And of course, as we've talked about before, I'm in favor of really putting teeth into regulation so that if one does not have one's child vaccinated, that's fine, but you're going to need to choose an option other than public school for your child.
And in fact, what this study and other studies show is when a parent has a child with autism, the subsequent children are less likely to get vaccinated, and that's a problem. Most of the outbreaks we've had in the United States have been in unvaccinated children, so this is a big issue.
And I'm hoping that we can stop talking about it very shortly. Let's turn, since we're talking about the pediatric population, to another study in JAMA. Something I thought was really, really interesting, provocative, and I'd love to have been in the mind of the people who thought of this. If you have a child with type 1 diabetes, in subsequent children, if they're given insulin, does that reduce their risk of developing diabetes?
In fact, Elizabeth, you've isolated the fact that in families that have a child with type 1 diabetes, this is diabetes usually developed oftentimes under the age of 2, is that subsequent children are also likely to have an increased risk. We've identified genetic abnormalities, what are called haplotypes, that predispose children to developing diabetes, which at that age, by the way, is an autoimmune disease, where the children, because of their genetic makeup, develop antibodies to the insulin-secreting cells in the pancreas. What this study tries to do is to take advantage of the fact that knowing it's an autoimmune disease, and by introducing some of the antigens or proteins through the mucosa in the mouth, we can actually develop immune tolerance instead of immune aggression. It's kind of a self-immunization. Let's pick those that are at high risk, give them oral insulin to see if we can actually elicit an immune response that could be protective. And that's exactly what the study did. It identified kids that have the genetic predisposition, they did not have diabetes, and they were randomized to either just getting placebo or oral insulin at varying doses. Did they develop an immune response that was thought to be protective? And what they discovered is in the 10 children that received placebo, there was no immune response. Of those that received insulin, especially the high dose, 83% of them developed an immune response that would likely be protective of either preventing them from developing diabetes or delaying the onset of it. It was such a short study, it didn't actually assess whether or not they developed diabetes. So that's where the next study should go.
To me, this sounds like a very provocative and interesting finding. I wonder if it says to us that anytime a sibling is born into a family with a child who already has type 1 diabetes, we ought to be thinking about prevention strategies.
The ones that they targeted only constitute about 1% of the children that develop type 1 diabetes. So it's a fairly small population. This is more of a proof of concept study, not a definitive study.
I think we're going to be seeing more of this, and I applaud the researchers for identifying this as a possible strategy. I think it's pretty provocative.
I think this is really novel. If you could give oral insulin at certain doses and actually prevent type 1 diabetes. So more to come on this.
Indeed. One question I neglected to ask, what are the potential problems with taking oral insulin at that age?
Well, in fact, they asked, were there episodes of hypoglycemia? And there were not, because less than 1% of the insulin is absorbed. There were no serious side effects at all.
More to come. This is good news. Let's turn from here to the New England Journal of Medicine. That story, of course, that we've been talking about for a long time, Ebola. In this case, what are the long-term effects of having been infected with the Ebola virus?
Elizabeth, it's funny because I never considered this as an issue. You know, we've spent all of our time trying to make sure people survived initial Ebola infection. And I never asked myself, gosh, are there long-term sequelae in these individuals who are survivors? It's important because of the recent outbreak, we finally have several hundreds and actually several thousands of individuals who were infected and subsequently are now survivors. This particular study invited adult survivors of the 2007 Ebola virus outbreak in Uganda and their contacts to take part in an observational study roughly 29 months after the outbreak. And they compared the infected individuals to the contacts that weren't infected. And they collected information about their health status and their functional limitations, and they collected a blood sample. They recruited 70 survivors and compared them to 223 contacts. What they discovered was that the survivors were significantly increased risk of developing eye problems, retroorbital pain, blurred vision, hearing loss, difficulty swallowing, difficulty sleeping, pain in the joints, and chronic health problems and limitations due specifically to memory loss or confusion.
And it sounds like there's a considerable neurotropic component to this.
There are. And 70% of these people could not go back to work or continue their usual activities. And so, Elizabeth, the question is there some persistent chronic infection or inflammation? There's still a lot more to be discovered.
Well, it sounds like we're going to be paying more attention to this one. Finally, let's turn to neurology. Since we're talking about the central nervous system, the CNS, what do you do when an adult has a first-time seizure?
These are evidence-based guidelines that talk about the management of an unprovoked first seizure in adults. If an individual has an unprovoked seizure, not due to a metabolic abnormality or not due to some other known cause, what's the likelihood they'll have another seizure? Do they benefit from anti-seizure medications? They ask and answer these questions by looking at the latest literature. For the adult who presents with an unprovoked seizure, what are the risks for seizure recurrence? The rate is somewhere between 21% to 45%, and most likely within the first 2 years of the first seizure. Can we identify high-risk features? And there are some, by the way. If someone's had a prior brain insult, stroke, or trauma, they're at twice the risk of having a seizure as those that didn't. If they have an abnormality on their EEG, their electroencephalogram, or if they have their seizure at night, a nocturnal seizure, they're twice as likely to have another one. The second question was, should those individuals be started on an anti-seizure drug immediately, or should you wait? Because if 21 to 45% have a recurrent seizure, that means somewhere between a half and three-fourths don't. And is there any benefit, by the way, or any harm to waiting? It appears that people that are started on an anti-seizure drug are less likely to have a second seizure in the first 2 years. But over the longer term, there's really no difference in quality of life and no benefit. So that means the individual could start if they want to, or they could delay knowing that they haven't caused any harm. What are the side effects? What's the risk of having an adverse event from the medication? And it looks like the adverse events range from about 7% to 31% of treated individuals, and they're most likely mild, they're reversible, and usually dose-related.
How often does this actually take place, an adult having a first-time seizure?
It's estimated that in the U.S. there are about 150,000 adults each year that have an unprovoked first seizure. Oftentimes, there is no identifiable cause. For that reason, you say, well, gosh, if everything looks fine, what do I do now? Is it likely to occur or not? And how do I treat it? And that's why these guidelines are beneficial.
Well, it sounds like then I didn't realize that there were that many adults in the U.S. who have a first-time seizure. So these are great guidelines to have on hand.
So Elizabeth, which of these articles do you want to highlight on the blog this week?
I bet you know which one I'm going to do.
The oral insulin.
You got it. That's exactly the one I'm going to write about. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.